flying saucers are real.
They've seen the aliens buzzing our missile silos.
The UFO phenomenon, either we like it or not, is already very much part of our reality.
That caused a compass needle to spin and spin.
And that's where the whole seed for the idea of underground bases at Dulce was planted.
They had very large eyes, and you know, I found their stare extremely difficult to bear.
Hi, everyone. This is Martin Willis. Welcome to Podcast UFO. Michael Lauk will be joining us in a few minutes. Today is a special day because there is a Vanity Fair article that's circulating like wildfire in the UFO field on John Mack and abductions, and it's by a veteran mainstream New York Times investigative reporter, Ralph Blumenthal. We have the exclusive interview, first interview with him on the subject ever, and that's coming up in a few minutes. So we're calling this Abduction Week because we have a special bonus podcast on Monday, and that's with Kathleen Martin and Denise Stoner on their new book. And also we have an account of a TV personality's UFO experience that's a mind blower. So make sure you check back with us on Memorial Day morning for our second podcast on Abduction Week. Michael, you have a blog?
Yes, I will have a blog up this week on the Allagash abductions.
Yeah. Hey, that's in my neck of the woods, so to speak. Quite a bit north of me. But anyway, before we get started, I want to give a special thanks to our guest star on the forum, and that was Chris Lambright. He answered many, many questions, did a great job. I really appreciate that. Our next guest star is Mac Maloney, UFOs and Wartime. He'll be on in a few weeks. So that's it for right now. Please check out our forum, and that's it. What's up for the news, Michael?
Next Saturday, May 31st, there will be a flyby of asteroid 1998 QE2, which is about 1.7 miles wide, and it will be zooming by the Earth at its closest point, which will be about 4:59 p.m. Eastern Time. The asteroid will be a safe 3.6 million miles or so away. However, this will be close enough for NASA to map it using radar imaging techniques, which will be able to sense surface objects as small as about 12 feet across. No doubt this data will help NASA with their missions to land on and eventually even capture other asteroids. Read more through the link in our show notes to the NASA coverage of the asteroid.
Yeah, that size of an asteroid, that's a killer asteroid, that size for sure. You know, I don't know if you heard this, but and I don't know if I'm pronouncing this right, but the Uppsala telescope that's in Siding Springs, it's in in Australia, the southern hemisphere, that's going to be closing in a few months, and that has spotted all kinds of asteroids. I think it's really important myself, not that we could do too much at this point, but we could at least see what's going to wipe us out if it happens.
Yeah, I'm more comfortable knowing as much of that as possible. But, you know, asteroids are very difficult to see from the ground, even with the best telescopes, because a lot of them aren't reflective.
Mm.
And that's one of the problems with doing it. So probably kind of radio telescopes and space-borne radio telescopes are going to be the wave of the future, hopefully. And pretty soon we're going to be capturing them anyway and just throwing them around the moon, evidently.
Yeah, I heard that. And they have all kinds of goodies on them, possibly diamonds, possible, or platinum and gold.
May 9th and 10th UFO sightings in South America can probably be explained by the return of a test payload launched by Orbital Sciences. The dummy load was used to simulate the mass of materials that would be loaded on the Antares rocket during future International Space Station resupply missions. So it was literally dumped into space after the test launch. Even though the load was expected to eventually fall back into the atmosphere and burn up, it caught many off guard. Read the NBC News coverage, which includes some home video of the load burning up in the skies over Chile, through the link in our show notes. Did you happen to see that?
No, again, I've been very busy this week. I haven't looked into that one at all.
It's only like a 7-9 second video. They cut out everything, but, you know, seeing this in the sky, and it is fairly impressive. It definitely would make you stop and go, what is that?
Do you know if a lot of people reported it as a sighting?
Evidently, it caused a pretty big stir, although when I looked at it, I went, okay, yeah, I can. That was obviously something falling just because it's going down and everything. But the pieces kind of, you know, I could see where you would interpret it as being in a formation, because they were very uniform and moved, you know, parallel to each other as they came down. You should watch the video. 7 seconds. It's 7 seconds of
all
your
right,
life.
I'll watch the video. Damn it.
In an interesting U.S. News and World Report article, albeit one that might be a bit short on proof, Jason Kebler posits that increased drone use is resulting in increased UFO sightings. Although the evidence is a bit circumstantial, the theory seems reasonable, and there is coverage of the steps one company is taking to make sure their craft are not misidentified by public safety agencies. Read more through the link in our show notes. And it is a very long link, so make sure you go to the show notes and click on that directly.
There's all kinds of things in the skies right now that people can misjudge as a UFO. For instance, there's the drones, as you say. There's a new solar plane. Have you seen that? It's a real real funky looking. And then last week you talked about some weird rocket launch in China, I believe it was.
Yes.
Then, of course, the main offender is the Chinese lanterns. They're everywhere.
They evidently are. You know, I don't. A lot of drones to me look like just small aircraft.
Yeah.
So I don't know where there's a lot of misidentification. I mean, the kind of roto drones are fairly rare when it comes to serious droning. So, but hey, any steps that they take to help, because you know, a lot of them do have that kind of stealth fightery triangle shape.
So if you happen to see one and it doesn't make any noise, then you can get more suspicious.
That's right. Or the FBI's after you.
Or both. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. The Kepler Space Telescope has been placed in a point rest state after the recent failure of a reaction wheel, part of the thruster system used for fine adjustment of the satellite. This new energy-conserving state means that the Kepler is no longer considered in critical condition. NASA can now evaluate all options while the Kepler Planet-Finding Space Telescope remains safe. Read their statement through the link in our show notes.
Yeah, I happen to know just a little bit about this. You know, the reaction wheel is kind of like a gyroscope. Now, the Kepler has to be very, very steady while it's taking these images, repetitive images. And so it shut down. It has four of them. And one of them shut down, so it can't remain real steady. However, it has a spare one that had shut down last year because of lubrication problems. So they're going to try to restart that one. And hopefully this can get straightened out, because I think the Kepler has done quite a lot for us. And before I forget, we have Dr. Seth Shostak on next week. He is from the SETI Institute, the senior astronomer. This time, we're not debating UFOs like we did in episode 21. We're just talking about Kepler and what SETI is doing trying to find life.
That should be a really interesting interview.
Yeah, it's good. And I think our news is going to be all related, more or less. It's going to be a little bit of a different podcast next Friday.
No, nothing. I've decided next week all news is going to be just oddball UFO stuff to connect to Seth Shostak's name.
Oh, just so we
get nothing but contactees and
awesome. So we can get Seth pretty angry. I love it.
People channel an alien.
He'll never come back.
In an article from The Week, reprinted on Yahoo News, Dana Liebelson explains how the efforts of UFO researchers have made it easier for others using Freedom of Information Act requests. Although there is no real UFO-related information, it is positive coverage of the subject and illustrates the legitimate research being accomplished in the UFO field. Read the article for yourself by following the link in our show notes. Did you happen to see that by any chance?
No. But I do, you know, my thoughts on this is, you know, there's a lot of good that the UFO field has done, you know, regardless of how a lot of skeptics look at it and debunkers.
Well, yeah, some of the lawsuits that have been filed, which is one of the things they talk about, have exposed kind of the government tricks to minimize your chances of getting anything useful out of a FOIA request. And it was actually a very interesting article. I'm sure you're going to read it as soon as we're done recording.
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm on it after I watch the video.
Right. 7 seconds of your life.
Yeah, okay. Yeah.
On May 16th, NARCAP posted a statement on their website explaining that they did not authorize use of their materials at the recent citizen hearing on disclosure and asking Stephen Bassett to remove any of their material from future video releases of the event. We have a link in the show notes, of course, to the statement. Martin, what do you think about this?
Michael actually took some time and read this. Their website. And yeah, they seem like they're pretty PO'd about this. I'm just going to quote this right here. You know, this is one thing. I'm going to try to say this in kind of an angry way. We have made it very clear to Mr. Bassett, the primary promoter of the citizens' disclosure hearing, that we did not agree to participate in the event, and we do not support this use of our materials. We do not agree with his conclusions, nor do we feel this interpretation of our data in any way is accurate or helpful in our work. In fact, we feel it is detrimental to our investigations, our research, and our image. It goes on and on about it. They are PO'd.
I have to admit, I'm not sure how I would view NARCAP if it didn't seem like such a slapdash response, because that's what it immediately makes me look at and go, why, this is, you know, this knee-jerk reaction that kind of damages their argument, because it makes, to me, in my mind, I don't know how other people view it. I'd like to actually hear everybody's opinion on that on the forums. I think there might even already be a thread about it.
Yeah. So that's it for the news, Michael?
That is it for this week.
Well, okay, and so Monday, be sure to check back with us for our bonus podcast. No news in that segment, the UFO encounter instead. And thank you, Michael, for your good work.
Why, thank you, and I will talk to you again next week.
I have Ralph Blumenthal on Skype. How are you, Ralph?
I'm fine, Marty. Thank you.
Thanks so much for agreeing to be on the show. I understand this is the first show you are on about your recent article in Vanity Fair.
It is.
That's great. I got the scoop.
Well, you're a lucky man, and so am I, to be interviewed by you.
So the article name is Alien Nation, Have Humans Been Abducted by Extraterrestrials? And it's mostly about John Mack. I have to ask a number of questions. First one comes to mind. You have had a prestigious career. Have you had any ridicule so far for this article?
Well, a few emails came in. I'm used to that. But actually, I was surprised by the positive reaction. I think everyone was so relieved to find a so-called mainstream journalist treating the subject seriously that I was quite flattered by the outpouring of positive reaction.
Oh, that's great. I was hoping it would encourage you, stay at what you're doing, but at least do a little more exploring. I think you did it's a wonderful article. And this is in Vanity Fair, so one of the most major magazines in the country. It's pretty exciting to see this article.
Well, thank you. Yes, it's on the website, actually. They couldn't get it into the magazine fast enough for the upcoming summer gathering in Newport. Of the experiencers, the abductees who meet there every year. So rather than try to update it with another gathering, because I attended the one last July, they decided to get it right up on the site. But it's a very active site. It had quite a while ago 25,000 individual page views and 2,000 shares. So it really seemed to have hit a nerve.
Yes, I bet. So you've heard mostly from the UFO community. Have you heard from other colleagues?
No, I really must say I've heard, a lot of my friends did see it and were a little surprised that I'd be writing about this. We can talk about that.
Yeah.
But also, there was quite a reaction in the UFO community. As you know, as well as anyone, it's a very tight-knit group. It's disparate, but people keep in touch with each other. And whenever there's a development, pro or con, there's a lot of sharing back and forth. So everybody tries to keep on top of things. And when this article came out, it was immediately sent back and forth. I could almost see it, flying through the cosmos. And I was getting responses from all over the place.
Yes, I right away... a past guest, actually just last week, Leslie Kane connected with me right away and said, you have to get a hold of this guy right away. And so I was really excited that you responded so quickly.
Oh, well, thank you. Leslie's one of my favorite people. You know, she is so clear-eyed and sober about the whole UFO thing. She's brought so much important investigative attention to the subject and high credibility. Mm-hmm. So she really is one of my favorite people. We did an article together for the Huffington Post on this Chilean episode, a very strange flyover that went so fast that it was only caught on film. But she is somebody I highly respect.
Well, that's great. Have you had an interest in the subject for quite a while?
Well, as I said in some of my proposals, I've talked to a number of publishers now. As a kid, I was very interested in science fiction. Growing up in the 50s, it was really the big thing. I mean, UFOs were suddenly on the agenda, and I gobbled up everything by Ray Bradbury and Isaac Asimov. So as a kid, I was certainly interested in it. But my interest came later when I picked up a copy of John Mack's Passport to the Cosmos. It was about 2004 or 5. And I said, gee, this is a guy I'd like to interview someday. I was already an established correspondent for the New York Times. And the next thing I heard, he'd been killed in London.
Mm.
So that's really where my interest started.
I see. Yeah, there's a little bit of controversy about his death. You know, I mean, it was kind of an unusual circumstance. It's probably just an accident, but still a little unusual.
Well, I have satisfied myself that it was an accident. I know, there are a lot of conspiracists out there, but it is important to stick to the facts. And while you can never prove a negative, I must say I've talked to the family, I've looked over the police reports, and there's nobody serious out there anymore who thinks it was any kind of anything else than a tragic accident. The driver was drunk, he admitted that. And John was very tired. He was coming back from a talk in London, and he stepped out of a subway station, underground station, was not used to the traffic patterns, looked the wrong way, and was hit and died almost instantly. So I think while the circumstances were so strange and unusual, given his notoriety at that point, particularly his fight with Harvard, there was immediately speculation that it was a hit or assassination, but I'm absolutely convinced, and so is everyone else who's looked at the subject seriously, that it was just an accident.
You know, I've heard of a lot of people getting in accidents in England in particular, you know, looking the wrong way, you know, just regular car accidents and things because you're so used to, you know, the right-handed traffic.
He was very tired. He had gone to talk about the great fascination of his life, which was T.E. Lawrence of Lawrence of Arabia. He'd written a book that won the Pulitzer Prize in 1977. So he'd gone to give a talk on Lawrence. He was up late. It was very emotional for him. It was sort of a lot of strange things. I mean, it was the anniversary just about to the day of his father's death in a vehicle accident. His father was killed in Vermont. In a car accident coming home from their summer home. There's also a lot of interesting things after he was hit and killed. People who had visitations from him or say they did. So he was getting very interested in survival, life after death. And this almost seemed tailor-made for his research. In that he himself, according to associates, appeared to them with messages after he died. So in that sense, it was kind of an extension of his life's work.
Wow. Let's talk about the Rhode Island event. Was that the first time and the only time you've ever gone?
It is, yeah. I had talked to, this is how I got onto it. As I started interviewing Mack's associates, they were telling me that he showed up periodically at a convention every year in Newport, Rhode Island, hosted by this woman who was a fairly prominent Newport resident, whose grandfather had a mansion there, part of old Newport, actually. And so I was kind of interested in that, but I never thought of going. Until last summer, I was in New Hampshire, and I was not far away, and I was talking to the woman who hosts these gatherings. Her name is Anne Cuvelier. She has a B&B in this beautiful mansion on the Newport waterfront, and she said I should come and attend, and it seemed an invitation too good to pass up because a lot of these experiences, as you know, Marty, are very publicity-averse. They're not looking for attention, contrary to what outsiders often believe, that these are either hoaxers or publicity seekers, fabricators looking for attention. It's quite the opposite. They're very troubled people based on what has happened to them. They were in trouble before, but they were troubled as a result of what they went through. So they were not looking particularly for attention. But she invited me to come and meet with them, and I had met many of them already. I thought it was a wonderful opportunity, which it turned out to be. It anchored the piece in Vanity Fair because it gave it a focus. And so it was a good device for telling the story. But it was also very important to me to meet not only experiencers, but scientists who were there, reputable scientists, astrophysicists who showed up, the director of a hospital in Boston who had all kinds of anomalous psychic experiences. So that's the story on Newport.
Mm-hmm. You speak in your article about when Mac was on Oprah with some experiencers. Have you ever seen tape of that?
Have. Uh-huh. I have. Very interesting because, first of all, it was fairly early in Oprah's television career. And you could see already what a good interviewer she was. She was a bit skeptical, but she was very accepting of these very strange stories. So not only was there Mac talking about the phenomenon, but he had a group of people, young people, who told very straightforwardly of their extraordinary experiences of taking aboard a craft and meeting these beings and missing time, the whole syndrome. So the fact that they were talking about it so casually and so lucidly, and that there were no visible signs of insanity, I mean, it was all very forward, and Oprah was really impressed.
Yeah, I would like to see that tape. Now, you know, I was wondering if there was any type of ridicule or something during that tape, or how the audience reacted, basically.
The audience was pretty accepting, and I think quite fascinated. Oprah would indicate her skepticism by a raised eyebrow or a quizzical look. And her intro actually is interesting. She said, we have here, John Mack. He believes that people have been abducted by aliens. He believes that they have had children with aliens. So she was, you could see her skepticism there. But the audience was quite supportive, especially once they had a chance to hear these people.
You know, the things I've seen a documentary on that I thought was pretty fascinating is when he went to Africa, when he was interviewing those children. You mentioned that briefly here. You know, it wasn't really abductions, but what an amazing story that is.
It is one of the most, the whole canon of alien abduction, as you know, revolves around certain very powerful stories. One is the story of Betty and Barney Hill. Mm-hmm. And one is the Linda Napolitano, so-called Brooklyn Bridge abduction, the Allagash incident. So there are a number of things that, were particularly, that loom large in the history of the abduction phenomenon. And one of them certainly is the incident at Rua in Zimbabwe. And as I sort of tell it in the Vanity Fair story and I hope to tell it in greater length in a book, Mac at the time was being persecuted, I think is the only way to describe what Harvard was putting him through. They'd subjected an inquisition for his willingness to entertain the reality of alien abduction. And while he was being subject to all these hearings at Harvard, he got a call, or his office did initially, from a BBC correspondent in outside Harare, Zimbabwe, that a children's school had had some kind of an episode, a visitation of a UFO, and the children saw beings, which they reported to the school authorities. And it had become quite a story in Zimbabwe, and Mac, despite all the troubles he was going through at Harvard, dropped everything and with his research partner flew to Zimbabwe to talk to these kids themselves. And Mac and his associate interviewed dozens of these kids, and they all had the same story, that they saw this craft come down. It was either hovering or landed. and they saw two or three beings, small, dark figures in form-fitting outfits, and they were communicating telepathically with the children, and the children were very troubled by it, and they all had similar story, which was interesting. It was hard to imagine that these kids could make all this up and keep their stories consistent.
Right.
And that's really the basis of that story, which is very, very powerful.
Yes. Getting back to your career, now you actually were involved in writing in Vietnam?
Yeah, I was a New York Times correspondent in Vietnam. It was early in my career. I had been a correspondent in West Germany at the time. And then they sent me to Vietnam. It was pretty much the high point of the war, 69, a year after Tet. It was fascinating. I was in Vietnam, covered a lot of the war. And then when the war shifted or spread to Cambodia, when Prince Sihanouk was overthrown and Cambodia sort of joined the war on the American side, which was a kind of a disastrous decision for them, they got drawn into it. And I covered that pretty much from the beginning. And then about the time Sidney Shanberg came in and covered the arrival of the Khmer Rouge, which became, of course, his wonderful movie, The Killing Fields.
Wow. Let's see. I just wonder if we should talk a little bit more about your career in general. What do you think?
Well, that's fine. I think it's very important for, you know, listeners to know that, you know, I come to this not as a proponent or an advocate. At least I didn't start off that way. I don't think I've become an advocate. I still consider myself a reporter. And I think that I hope that that's the strength of my reporting, that I come to it as a reporter. And the one thing, I've really stuck in my investigative reporting over the years. I've been involved in a lot of political exposés for the New York Times. My training is to stick to the facts. Mm-hmm. And I think, I hope that what I've brought to this story is an adherence to the facts, an openness to hear things and to understand things, but also an innate skepticism. I don't believe anything anyone tells me on the face of it, and that everything has to be tested.
Right. I think what is lacking is the one word you just mentioned out there is the openness to at least investigate. And it's like a breath of fresh air to have someone like you actually investigate something like this.
Well, you know, I sort of took my cues from John Mack, who also described at great length in his books and all his interviews how he came to it as a skeptic. It's an interesting story. He was brought up as a scientist. His whole family had been eminent physicians at Harvard. His training was science. He was he had to be a medical doctor before he could be a psychiatrist. So he trained. I have a photo of him conducting an autopsy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he was a man of science. And he was an activist, a social activist. He believed in, ending nuclear weapons. So politically, he was certainly on the left. But he was a strictly man of science. And when he eventually started learning about this anomalous world. He had taken breathwork training with Stanislav Grof and his wife. And he had learned, psychiatrists deal in hypnosis and alternate states all the time.
Mm-hmm.
He was always aware that there were some hidden corners of the human mind, which every psychiatrist knows. But he began experimenting himself. He tried some psychotropic drugs, hallucinogenic drugs, and he was surprised at the things they brought out in him. He had had a very traumatic youth. His mother died when he was 7 months old. His father remarried, but he always missed his mother. So a lot of these issues came out when he was experimenting with drugs. So he knew that there were some hidden corners of the human mind, but nothing prepared him for the letters that Bud Hopkins showed him. When Mac met Bud Hopkins, and Hopkins said he'd been getting these letters from people who had been abducted or said they'd been abducted, and Mac looked at them and was trying to figure out what was going on. He didn't believe it either.
Do you know how they first met?
Yeah, Mac had been dabbling in some of these interesting groups like EST on the West Coast. You know, it was an era of great experimentation, sexual experimentation, you know, psychiatric experimentation. All these things were going on in the 50s and 60s, a great opening up. And he was an eager participant. And there was a woman in one of these groups on the coast in California who knew Bud. Bud Hopkins was a very accomplished artist who had himself seen a UFO on Cape Cod in the 60s and had written about it. And this woman became a kind of a bridge between Mac and Bud Hopkins. She told Mac, she had met Mac, I guess, on the coast and said, there's this guy, Bud Hopkins, who's really interesting. You should meet him. So Mac said he always remembered the date. It was, you know, in 1980, I believe. And he went to visit Bud, and Bud showed him these letters. So that's how it came about.
I see. In the article you wrote, you talked briefly about the Brooklyn Bridge UFO abduction. Do you know more details about that? I've heard about that, but I've never really...
Well, I do. It's really one of the most sensational, that's certainly a fair word to use, cases that have ever come up. I mean, of course, the Hills story is very sensational. Mm-hmm. They're all sensational. There's not an abduction story that's not. But the Linda Napolitano, I call her by her real name, which she gave me permission to do. Bud Hopkins gave her a pseudonym in his book. But I'll give you the story very quickly. A major world figure, this is in Bud Hopkins' telling of the story, a major world leader was on his way downtown to a meeting with two bodyguards. His car suddenly came to a stop under the FDR Drive on the east side of Manhattan, and they didn't know what was wrong with the car. They stopped and got out and were looking around, and again, this is according to the story told in Bud Hopkins' book and the story that Linda later told me. The world leader and the two bodyguards saw a spacecraft hovering over a building near the Brooklyn Bridge. To their amazement, they saw a figure come out of the window, levitate out of the window, followed by three small beings who had come out of the spacecraft. They all floated toward the spacecraft. The spacecraft then shot over the East River, over the Brooklyn Bridge, and plunged into the water. That was the story.
Uh-huh.
There were some witnesses on the Brooklyn Bridge, drivers whose cars had also stalled. There were witnesses at the New York Post printing plant. Anyway, and in his book, Witnessed, Bud Hopkins tells this story. And later when I met Linda, the woman who was supposedly levitated out of her window, she confirmed the story to me, at least in her experience. This is what she remembered, you often under hypnosis. It's very hard to recover these memories because they're very clouded. Anyway, there was no way in the context of this article or even in a book of my own that I could completely check out this story. It's become kind of controversial because different people have claimed it was a hoax, and it's really spurred a very lively debate online. But at least I was able to talk to Linda, and the world figure who Bud Hopkins never identifies in his book but is identified in other articles online is supposedly the former Secretary General of the United Nations, Javier Perez de Cuellar, who was on his way to a meeting. I did get the chance through a news colleague to get some questions to de Cuellar, who's now retired in Peru. And he was asked about this whole episode, and his responses were quite enigmatic. He said he didn't really remember, he didn't deny it, but he said he has no interest in these types of stories. But it was not exactly a flat denial. It's a very peculiar story, to say the least.
Mm-hmm.
At least I was able to track down some of the figures, as like Linda, for example, and Leslie Kane, who was close to Bud Hopkins, has a lot of his original research and was able to confirm, you know, some of the outlines of the story. So again, that's the so-called Brooklyn Bridge abduction, and the story goes on that Linda was taken to a strange place, some beach, and one of the people she was abducted with came back with some of the sand, but it had been tested. And as usual in these stories, it's inconclusive. There's never enough physical proof to be persuasive. That's one of the mysteries of the whole, UFO and alien abduction phenomena.
Mm-hmm.
No one has ever been able to come back with incontrovertible scientific proof. There's always tantalizing things. There's little cuts that heal quickly. There's witness sightings that coincide with abductions. You know, there's a pattern of evidence, or fragmentary evidence, that falls short of incontrovertible proof.
That's the way it seems like it's always been. Since you've written this article, have you considered what you would do if someone contacted you and started relaying their abduction experience to you, where you would go with that?
Well, some people have actually contacted me. They've also contacted, they told me they've been in touch with other, groups, and had talked to Mac at the time. So I would definitely talk to them. I've interviewed a few of them for what I hope will be my book. So I've heard these stories firsthand myself. I've tested them, checked them out. I've talked to other people. For example, there's a young woman in Massachusetts who told me all kinds of stories. And she told me about an episode where she felt she was abducted from her bedroom. And I talked to her, to check it, to verify it. I talked to her husband. They've since separated, but they're in good terms. And he was what struck me particularly is he's a police officer.
Hmm.
Was able to confirm some of the details. He was, as is very common, as you know, he was kind of paralyzed. He couldn't move, but he saw the flashing red light. He felt the presence in the room. He felt her struggling when she was, abducted. So here's a police officer, with some degree of credibility, still working as a law enforcement officer, who confirmed some of the outlines of the story. So I have talked to quite a few of these people, and wherever possible, tried to get outside confirmation. It's very difficult, as you know, and again, it always falls short of, full scientific proof. But I'm happy to, hear these stories and meet with people and just listen to them.
Would you attend any other, for instance, there's an experiencers conference right in my neighborhood up in Portland, Maine, this September. Would you ever consider attending one of those?
I would. I mean, I know there are a lot of these conferences. There's the MUFON conference, every year. There are a lot of groups meeting, and the hard part is, to keep up with all of it. And as you know, there's also, it is a kind of a mixed bag. I mean, there's mm-hmm. some groups are more credible than others, and one, I think, has to be careful to, focus, I have to be careful to focus my effort on the more reliable and rewarding of the conferences or so, because there's so many of them. But, for example, I talk in my article about the famous abduction conference at MIT that took place in the 90s. It was extraordinary, put on by David Jacobs and David Pritchard, and MIT was the, shall we say, reluctant host. But it did open its doors to this very prestigious high-level conference where a lot of papers were presented and the issue was looked at from various perspectives. So that became its own book by C.B. Bryan, the great writer who wrote Friendly Fire. He wrote a book, Close Encounters of the Fourth Kind, just about that conference. I wish I had attended that.
Mm-hmm.
At Harvard, at the Harvard Divinity School, not open to outsiders, but a conference of a lot of professionals, including Mac, to look at this problem and issue and see what they could make of it. So, there are conferences, I think, that are very worth attending.
You mentioned briefly a book. Do you have do you have something in mind?
I do. I've been trying for the longest time to sell a book on John Mack. It has not been easy because of the mindset that we were talking about. There's a lot of hostility, I would say more than skepticism, hostility in the publishing community, even though books keep coming out about, you know, UFOs and abduction and movies, for sure. The mainstream publishing community is quite skeptical or hostile. And Mack was not seen as enough of a figure to anchor a book. So I've had a lot of difficulty selling it as an idea. I think in the end I'll prevail. I have some interest now. I think I know where I'm going on it. And I think the Vanity Fair article really helped show the interest. But it has not been easy.
I bet. We're getting near the end of the show here. Have you had any of these type of experiences or your family that you're aware of?
No, I've really searched my memory because a lot of these experiences are deeply buried, as you know, and often come out only in connection with something else. But I can't say I've never seen a UFO that I can remember, and I'm glad I have not had these troubling experiences because I know how people suffer. As you know, they tend to occur in families. So if your grandparents and parents have had abduction-type experiences, you're more likely to, and that has not been a pattern in my family. It tends to happen early in life, not late in life. So it's as if these beings, whatever they are following people from generations, which might be some kind of study. But it does seem to be, that seems to be the pattern. So in my case, no. And as I say, from what I've seen about the deeply traumatic effects, I can't say I'm sorry. I have not, you know, been singled out or had these experiences because they're very, very difficult. I've been rereading Whitley Strieber's book and how he was tortured by you know, his experiences. They're very troubling. You know, the skeptics are always trying to make a link between these experiences and mental illness.
Mm-hmm.
Truth is, to the extent these people are mentally disturbed, it's what's happened to them as a result of their experiences. They're not mentally disturbed and conjuring up these experiences. They're perfectly normal people until they encounter these inexplicable events, and then they're thrown off center, as you would. Mack found that many people hoped to be told that they were insane, the way they could deal with what had happened to them. So when he gave them the bad news that they were not crazy, that other people have had these same experiences and they were witnesses and something had happened to them in some dimension, they were even more troubled because they lacked any system for processing that information.
Well, it sure is a mysterious phenomenon.
It is, and that's the thing. I think it'll remain mysterious for a long time to come. I'm very pessimistic that we're close to a solution. I think it's just something we're going to have to keep studying.
That's right. Ralph, you've been amazing. I'm so glad that you've written this article, and I hope to see your name in print a number of times in the future about this.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's a great pleasure.
Yes.
This was not my first space flight. Previous assignments for my newspaper had sent me to the moon many times, but never into the vast reaches of deep space.
What's the matter, Sonny? Are you scared? What's the matter, sonny?